Call to order the Education Subcommittee of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. This is Thursday, June 19th, 2003, and we will open a work session on House Bill 5016, which is the state school fund bill within the Department of Education. Ms. McGlashan, could you talk to the committee members about what we will be doing today? And my intention is to trap the committee into this room until we get our job done.
Thank you. Madam
Chair. Except for Senator Gordley, who is carrying the 0103 reconciliation bill on the Senate floor and a number of other bills.
Right, and I have asked that those bills be moved to the bottom of the calendar so that I'll be in this room as long as possible.
I appreciate that very much. Mm-hmm.
And, Madam Chair, I have 6 bills to carry in the House floor.
No kidding?
Yeah.
Holy moly.
You've been stuck with a lot of bill carrying.
Well, this all happened at the same time.
Okay. Ms. McGlashan.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, and guests, we have today Brian Reeder from the Department of Education is here to talk about the quality education model, and also Frank McNamara from the Quality Education Commission, as well as Ron Wilson from OSBA and Jim Sager from the Governor's Office. To answer any questions you may have left over from yesterday about contracts or other issues that we discussed yesterday. But what we thought we'd do is start with Brian covering the quality ed model information that's before you. And you have a couple of handouts on the quality ed model, which he'll be going through. And one is a stapled document, and it has the quality ed model impact analysis for the 0305 biennium at the top, and then it has some attachments in the back. That's one version of the model we'll be going over today. A second one is just a single sheet of paper, front and back, and Brian will be going over that one as well. And that also is a model impact analysis, but as you'll find out, it has some different numbers, and he'll be discussing why. So we thought we would get right into that today.
Before we do that, I have neglected my chairly duties and would like to take this opportunity to welcome Representative Gilman to the committee. And Representative Gilman is from House District 55, which is one of the larger, more strangely shaped districts in the state. And we welcome your participation on our committee. Mr. Reeder.
Thank you, Chair Morgan, members of the committee. Brian Reeder with the Department of Education. What I'd like to do is to start with a brief summary of really what the quality education model is and the underlying structure and purpose of the model. And I'll ask that Frank jump in where appropriate and add anything if I leave anything out. And then we can start talking a little bit about some of the numbers that we've generated over the past few days using the model. The quality ed model was built, 5 or 6 years ago. The initial commission or group was created by then Speaker of the House Lynn Lundquist to generate a tool that the legislature could use to help in the budgeting process, to help understand the level of resources that Oregon schools have and the level that would be needed to achieve the education goals that are currently in statute. What the model does is it creates what we call prototype schools. It builds or designs these schools, one elementary, one middle, and one high school, based on the most current research available on what an effective school would look like, the size of the school, the staffing levels of the school, the activities that go on in a school, the number of counselors needed, the level of technology, the level of centralized administrative support, and so forth to operate an effective school. And then operationally, we take those prototypes and scale them up to the full statewide level to reflect the number of students we have in Oregon, and that will tell us what it will cost. You know, once you determine the level of resources, in other words, number of teachers and class sizes you want and so forth, you can put a cost on those by determining what those resources, what the prices of those resources are out in the market, and that will give you an estimate of what it will cost to run those schools statewide. We typically have estimated two versions of the model. The first is the one that most people are familiar with, and that is if we took all the recommendations of the Quality Ed Commission for class size and level of resources and technology and textbooks and counselors and extracurricular activities and so forth, how much would it cost to provide that those types of schools in Oregon for all of Oregon's students? And that's what we call the full QEM. And that's the $6 billion or the $6.9 billion number that people have been talking about recently for 03-05. The other version of the model is more a reflection of where we are today, the level of resources that schools currently have in terms of number of teachers and so forth. And that's what we call the baseline. So the baseline is a reflection of current conditions in Oregon. And the baseline is always reflective of a given point in time. And in this case, the baseline is constructed to reflect the level of resources we had in the 2001 school year. And the reason that year is relevant is because that's the latest year that we have complete data in order to estimate all the parameters that are in the model. As another year of data becomes available, we can update that baseline year to a more recent year.
So the latest year is 01?
Correct. We are currently, most of the data in the QEM, a large share of the data required for the QEM is financial data, because it tells us how much things cost. And that data is audited data from school districts. And so audits come in after the school year is over. They come into the department roughly in December following the end of the school year. And then it takes us typically 3 months to reconcile all that data to make sure that it's correct.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordy,
if I may seek a clarification, you said the baseline currently is based on 01. Is that 01, 02, or just 01?
2001.
Okay. All right.
So if I might continue, Mr. Reeder, so 02's data would have been received by December of 03 or 02?
December of 02.
And then by March of 02, you would have cleaned it.
Well, roughly by March. This year has been particularly difficult because we've had more cleanup of the data this year than has been typical of prior years, and we've had some staffing issues at the department that have been difficult to work through.
Well, I can imagine that because of the fiscal situation, that the record-keeping issues have been pretty challenging for districts.
They've been very challenging for the districts. We have a larger than normal share of districts who got their data in late, and then when we get back to districts to ask for clarification or correction, it's been a much slower turnaround.
Madam Chair.
And where I'm going with it is just to try to pin down when we can expect to have the 02 data.
Chair Morgan, as of yesterday, we had complete clean data from all but 9 districts. Seven of those districts are quite small and therefore would have very little impact on sort of general measures. Two of them are medium-sized districts, and we're just having difficulty getting corrected data from those districts.
So it isn't possible to estimate at this point, then?
I believe it is possible. The difficulty is that fully updating the QEM with a new year of data is a fairly lengthy process. It's a very labor-intensive process that takes probably a month or two to fully complete. And typically, we've done that as part of the Quality Ed Commission's regular schedule, which will start for the coming cycle. Will start typically in the fall of this year.
So if you stayed on your normal schedule, then you would have the O2 data in the model sometime during the fall?
That's correct.
Thank you. Senator Gordley, I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No problem. Just a couple of points. In your overview of the role of the Quality Education Commission, I don't believe that it's been made clear as possible that there is a statutory role for the Quality Education Commission captured under ORS 327.506, and the charge of the commission is to determine the amount of monies sufficient to ensure the state system of K-12 public education meets the quality goals, which are also established in statute. So again, I just think we need to be mindful that we're talking about a commission that has a statutory role. With that said, in getting back to the data collection, are there any questions at all about the reliability of the data?
Chair Morgan, Senator Gordley, as with any data, there are always questions about reliability. No data is ever completely correct, but the department has worked extremely hard over the past 5 years since the beginning of the database initiative project to put in place a structure that assures the highest quality data that we can get. We do training of school district business office personnel in how to report the data. We have a what we call the chart of accounts, which is the accounting structure on which they base their data reporting, and we continually offer training and updates to districts on how to follow that chart of accounts to the in the way that it was intended. Each year when we clean up the data that they submit to us, when we find problems, we talk to the districts about the problems that with the data they submitted and inform them of the proper way to report that data. And what we've seen is a sort of a continual improvement over the past few years in the quality of the data, and by that I mean we're finding fewer major errors in reporting from the districts. This year was a bit unusual. I don't think that it was primarily a problem of more errors. It was simply a problem of taking more time to correct the ones that are there. So I think the data is getting better and better over time, due primarily to the training efforts that the department has done with school districts.
Another question, Madam Chair.
Absolutely.
For Mr. McNamara and Mr. Reeder, how should we look at special education as it relates to the prototype? Looking back at a report from the Special Education Task Force, and their report was issued on December 4th of last year. One of their recommendations was that was to expand the quality education model to include special education programs and services. Given that recommendation, what should be our understanding today about the place of special ed in the prototype and the cost associated with special ed?
Madam Chair, Frank McNamara, I represent COSA, and I was the staff person for the quality ed model for the the volume that came out. That's the 2000 model, and I've continued to be a staff person with them as they completed the most recent report, and I was on the commission for the first round when it was the Quality Ed Council that was created by Speaker Lundquist.
Mr. McNamara, would you kindly pull the microphone closer? I'm having difficulty hearing you.
Okay. Sorry.
Thank you.
Several items of both cost and program and service have been treated weekly, I think, in the original models and up through the current. One of those is special ed. The commission did have the report from the special ed task force in front of them as they completed the draft of the current model structures, but they did not have incorporated in it the recommendations that were in that report because those, many of them, required legislative action, which most of which has not happened. So in the model, in terms of special ed students, the model does account for, in a prototype school, services that would be needed for special ed students. And it assumes a certain level, a certain percentage of the students in the school are special ed need students. And it provides staffing in a way that would staff resource rooms that would provide extra services to classroom teachers with special ed students in their incorporated in their regular classrooms, and it has some special services outside. The original model actually established, in theory, a fund outside the model cost for special education. I believe it was, Sue may remember, $40 million that was outside the model. $40 billion out. That's federal numbers. I'm sorry.
It's real money.
$40 million outside the model that would provide for kids with the highest level of need. The recommendation from the task force to the legislature, which was also picked up and incorporated in this round of the model, to separate out the highest cost students for a fund other than the regular state school fund for their support. That is, kids who are, I can't remember if we ended up with a 4X or a 5X, four times the cost or five times the cost, as a special fund. So the assumption in the model is that students will be served in their own schools, in classrooms, resource rooms that is separated for some services as they're needed, and it provides staffing at best practices level for those students in the prototype schools.
Additional follow-up, Senator?
Thank you. Taking into consideration the federal mandates under No Child Left Behind, how should we regard the dollars that are available through that mandate as part of determining the baseline, the QEM baseline?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, the affectionately known as Nickleby, No Child Left Behind, Nickleby, I don't have it in front of me, the actual cost. I believe that the federal government anticipated in its allocations something like $4 billion nationwide as additional allocation to implement Nickleby. The estimates run from conservative estimates of $80 billion to more generous, some would say more accurate, estimates of $120 billion. So while and it's a government kind of thing, with a pea under shell kind of activity, where a lot of elements of allocation are rolled into one new allocation, and you know, it's like the old allocations become this new allocation. But the net gain to school funding is going to be probably 5 to 10% at the low end, 5 to 10% of what the actual expected cost for implementing Nickleby will be.
Is a part of what you're saying to us, Mr. McNamara, is that a part of the No Child Left Behind allocation falls outside of the model?
Chair Morgan and Senator Gordley, that wouldn't be what I was meaning. Oregon is reasonably well positioned both in the way it has established its standards and its assessment process to parallel and implement the requirements in Nickleby. The issue is whether there is new federal funding that's to help us implement that, and the answer to that is no, there isn't. So we're on our own. We have some advantage over many other states in that what we are already doing, what is already in your plan in terms of state standards and assessment, aligns well with the Nickleby requirements.
And just two or three more questions, Madam Chair.
Please.
With regard to improving teacher quality, are we to understand that funding for improving teacher quality is also one of the items, if you will, that is part of the baseline?
Yes, that's in the model and in the baseline. There are assumptions made in terms of best practices about the need for staff development and the quality of the staff delivering services. And so there is funding incorporated in the model that provides for some of that staff development, staff training.
Do we also have a method of tracking how a given district is actually using dollars for improving teacher quality? Is there an accountability mechanism?
Both the budget and audit would capture what expenditures are used for. There are items that would identify staff development within that. So I would think through the database, and Brian might be able to respond better to that, that in the database they would be able to capture both budget that is projected, here's what we think we're going to do, and audit, here's what we actually did, that those items would be captured there.
And Mr. Reeder, do you have anything that you could add to the question?
Chair Morgan, Senator Gordley, we do capture data on spending on those activities. We don't, as far as I know, the department does not capture data on just what specific activities are done by districts for professional development, nor have we, and the reason is this is an extremely difficult thing to do, do we know how effective those teacher professional development programs are.
So there's no link between the development program spending and the achievement side of the data?
Yeah, Representative Morgan, I think if you look at the research, the in teacher quality, one of the greatest challenges is to not only just define what that means, but to measure just what a quality teacher is in any objective way. So I think the state of the art today is that we don't know how to measure what a quality teacher is and how to quantify that. I mean, it's one of those things where you know a good teacher when you see one, but how you measure that is really not, we don't know how to do that.
Well, and I think we've also had discussions in this subcommittee about the difficulty of just the mechanical difficulties of correlating both sides of those pieces.
Well, Madam Chair, I think that there are those who would argue with Mr. Reeder's statement. The Education Trust is one research-based organization that comes to mind that could tell us in very exact terms what makes a good teacher, if you will. So I don't want to get into that discussion and argument with you, but I have some other questions I'd like
Please to. Proceed, Senator.
Do we have a way of tracking at the district level how the NCLB funds are being spent? Does the department have a mechanism for tracking?
Mr. Reeder.
Chair Morgan, Senator Gordley, we are currently putting in place revisions to our chart of accounts that will capture that data, yes.
Okay. Migrant education. Is migrant education factored into the quality education model?
Chair Morgan, Senator Gordley, as a specific component of the model, no, it's not. There is specifically a component in the model that provides resources for ESL programs, provides counseling for students with special needs. Migrant students would fall into that category. It does not identify specifically migrant education, but I think the structure of the model allows resources for those sorts of things.
Would that could that be considered a flaw in the model, in that it doesn't account for migrant education currently? That's a significant demographic group.
Yeah. Madam Chair and Senator Gordley, the I don't know that I use the word flaw, but it is certainly a weakness in the model, just like the special education piece that I mentioned earlier. It was something that the commission was aware of, something that staff took into account, and what they did was try to build in some best practices in a school that had something like a 5%. I think that was the original, and I think it's still the assumption about what proportion of your students would be EEL. Or ELL, excuse me, English language learners. And I think the commission has acknowledged in their documents that this is a weakness in their model. They haven't captured that well. And because it is a prototype, that is an assumed model with some basic assumptions in it, doesn't look like any particular school. So if you went to Woodburn and looked at a school, the model would be very much out of alignment with their actual needs and services there, as it would in any school, although the higher the proportion of ELL students and the higher the proportion of special ed students outside of the model prototype, the more of a disconnect there would be in the model. The presumption has been, in terms of how schools deliver services, that they have standards to meet. And if they meet the standards for all of their population of students, basically the state is not going to be worried about them and they're not going to draw any particular attention. If they don't meet the standards, then we begin to worry about them and we begin to look at how does your school look compared to this model that is built on best practices, and how does it look compared to all of the quality indicators for staffing and delivery. So it's really at the point when you're not delivering on what the requirement is in terms of the goals set by the state and the standards of the State Department that you begin to say, all right, now let's look at you compared to something. And then we'd look to the trust and to the model and to other examples of what are the ways that people know work and why aren't you using them.
Exactly. One last question for this round, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm.
The rural low-income school program, is that also factored into the QEM?
Chair Morgan, Senator Gordley, the model has assumptions about socioeconomic status of the students in the prototype schools. So in a again, in a general sense, it captures various income levels of students. The model currently does not distinguish between rural and suburban or urban schools, although recently, as part of the study of small schools that the department did, we developed a small school prototype, mm-hmm. and that typically would fit primarily rural schools. And to the extent that those many of those rural schools are higher poverty than the statewide average, then that would capture to some extent those conditions. One thing I would like to point out is that this model, like any model, is a representation of reality, and it can never fully capture all the variation that we see in the real world. And it's also an evolving thing. As we identify issues that need more attention, we will work them into the model. We will adjust the model to reflect that. I think special education is a very good example. Migrant education is another example. Variations in student achievement across income classes or ethnic groups is another example where we need more attention, and that where we can build that capability into the model over time.
Your comment leads me to one last question. And when we look at the model, it's based on moving 90% of our students, Oregon students, to benchmark, which leaves some assumptions about the remaining 10%. What are those assumptions? Who are those students in the view of the commission?
Chair Morgan, Senator Gordley, I think the 90% goal established initially by the commission was not intended to be a final goal. When you talk about a funding model, it's really necessary in order to determine an appropriate funding level to know or make an assumption about what you want, what results you want to achieve. The commission decided that given the level of performance that we currently see in Oregon, that getting 90% of students to standards was a fairly ambitious goal and a good one to try to achieve. I don't think it should be interpreted as saying that we'll be happy when we get there, that we'll be content to leave 10% of those students behind. In terms of who those students are, I mean, if you look at achievement levels by different categories of students, I believe those students are students in poverty, students whose first language is not English, and students from ethnic minority groups. The achievement gap that Superintendent Castillo has talked about wanting to close, I think, is focused on those students. I think the other group is also probably special education students when measured against the standards in statute for performance. Those students are not achieving at the level as the general student population is. But it is the goal of the department to get all students to standards.
I'd like to hear Mr. McNamara's response to this.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I don't know if this is visible enough for you, but what
I can see it.
What we
more visible.
It's called manual graphics.
You can see it from there. What the commission dealt with was we said in the state that we've got this standard that essentially is to be met at about the 10th grade, could be met by the 12th grade, but all students are to get here in reading and writing and math and science and so on. And we had students when we started who were scoring as they began their education down here. And we said, all right, now what is the trajectory for them? That is, what do they have to do each year. And so there'd be lines along here at the 3rd, 5th, 8th, and 10th grade that say by the time we get to those positions, I've got that upside down, huh? The time we get to those positions, we need to have
far
students.
Enough, well, we can't tell a difference. Okay.
You know, you have to be along this line. And at the third grade here and so on up until you hit that 10th grade or 12th grade level. And under this, when we started, we said under the current practices and under the current funding levels and resources, this is the this dotted line is the trajectory that we could expect our students to move at. So the question was, how do we close the gap between that dotted line trajectory that would be the normal nothing change line and this solid line, which is here's what it would take to actually get there for everybody? And when you start closing that gap, there are places along the line where it gets more and more costly, where you need more and more resources. And that would be particularly with, for instance, English language learners and special ed students. So you're, you know, where it takes 100 units of resource to get a regular student someplace, it'll take 150 or 200 units of resource to get some of the kids who start out further behind or who have more difficult issues to be dealt with as they move forward through their school experience. So what the model was about was, what does it take to close the gap? And it is a geometric issue as you move up that, you know, for the first 75% of your students, your resources are probably pretty good as they are. But if you want to get the next 10% and get to 85% of the students, it takes more resources. If you want to get to 95% of the students, you'll have to double that. It'll take more resources. And you want the last 5%, you got to triple that because they're proportionately more costly to provide services for. You need special ed people, one-on-one services, for instance, with some special ed students, special placements outside of the home and outside of the regular school program and so forth. So they're proportionately harder to get to that line that you want them at. Mm-hmm. Now, what the model did initially was make an assumption that economy of scale didn't work at some point, and we simply wouldn't make it with many of the students. And I think what the commission thought of for those students was that they were primarily students who had very serious handicapping conditions for whom accommodations would be very costly, and they would have trouble making it. Now, where the attention has gone in the commission since that first round has been more and more to what we know nationally and locally as closing the gap. That is, the kids in poverty primarily, and many of those kids of color, are not getting the attention and services that they require, particularly in these earlier stages where it makes the most difference and where it's the least expensive to close the gap. Mm-hmm. So they're getting more attention, and Superintendent Castillo has recently increased that focus for closing the gap, both on the kids in poverty and for kids with who are not English speakers in their home language in the family. So some attention is being given to that. I do not think that the model currently adequately addresses that. I think they made some revisions in this round to take that into account, but I think the commission would quickly acknowledge that we're probably still not there, even if you provided the resources that they're currently defining for you. Just one other comment along that line, and that is, I think it is a danger for us to begin thinking about the model, the same as I think is a danger as we think about the state school fund, for us to designate the dollar for a particular program. It's another instance where I believe it is more important for us to be saying, we have goals for you. We have these standards. Get your kids there. And we trust that you're going to use the best practices and you're going to get those kids there. But we'll only trust so far. And the distance of that trust is if you're not making any progress, if there's no movement, if we don't see the gap closing, if we don't see the achievement scores and the achievement of those students altering for the better. And when that happens, then, and this is incorporated into the No Child Left Behind in a very rough and gross way, and some ways inappropriate ways, but the concept is there, and that is that if you're not meeting standards, then the state has a reason to be paying special attention to you. The state has a reason then to say, okay, what's going on? Are you really using best practices? What have you done with staff training? What have you done with the qualifications of the people that you're hiring? How are you keeping them up to standard? Are you looking at research? Are you making database decisions on the kind of programs that you're using? But it's at the point when you have a reason for that, and that is if there's no positive change going on, and you say, okay, let's take a look at it.
Thank you. I'm going to interject here because we are now an hour into the time that the committee has been meeting, and I would really like to move the discussion on to allow Mr. Reeder to take us through the model and talk to us about how it's constructed. Representative Bates, yeah, very briefly.
Very brief. I've held my questions, and a great deal of them have been answered. It's been long, but Madam Chair, I think the hour we've spent here is important, and frankly, I wouldn't even want to close it down now. QEM we're going to be discussing here is based on certain assumptions, which I have some questions about now after the discussions this morning. I have worries about whether QEM answers No Child Left Behind. I have questions about whether the formula we use to distribute the money in the general formula answers those questions also. Are the funds going to the schools that need them the most? And that last 10% is important. No Child Left Behind says we leave no child behind. We're automatically saying 10% is left behind, and that's primarily, from my experience as a school board member, in the schools that need the help the most. We're cutting school days, we're cutting teachers' salaries, we're cutting our programs back and saying we're going to do these other things at the same time. It doesn't seem to me that's possible. But having said that, I'll stop.
Thank you very much. Mr. Reeder, please.
Could I just lay a couple questions on the table and they can respond?
Very briefly, Senator. We really need to move on.
I understand. I very much appreciate that. Two questions. Number one is the inquiry is to the special ed students, particularly where they require one-on-one, and you can get back to them in any form in the future. How many of those students are in homeschooling, and do we have a process in our model or in our process where we assist those parents who are able to homeschool those kind of disabled students? Second question.
Well, Mr. Reeder, could you answer that one?
Chair Morgan, Senator Mesley, the model does not in address homeschooling at all.
Second question, Madam Chair, is does the model factor in those districts that are losing enrollment, and particularly those that have had a record of losing enrollments, and sometimes very severely? It seems to me that would reflect on their ability to maintain the quality model.
Chair Morgan, Senator Mesley, the question you ask really relates to individual districts and is more of a question related to the distribution of resources and distributing resources to districts based on their characteristics that may cause their costs to be higher. The QEM, as it currently exists, is not a distribution model. That has been identified by a number of people as a flaw to the model. It is one of the issues that the Commission has talked about, and I think we'll continue to talk about. I think that at some point the QEM probably will incorporate some distribution issues, some components related to distribution and how costs vary based on how district characteristics vary, but at the current time it doesn't.
Just a very brief comment that I believe that at least 65% of the districts in the state now are losing enrollment, and I would think that would be a factor which needs to be addressed.
I do agree, Senator, but I also am, I think that it is an issue in the distribution formula and not an issue in the quality education model. Mr. Reeder, could you please take the committee through the construction of the model and the various assumptions that are built into it?
Chair Morgan, members of the committee, I believe Sue McGlashan has provided you with a handout. It's a multi-page handout. The heading on the first page is Quality Education Model Impact Analysis for the 0305 Biennium. And under policy scenario, it starts out revised QEM baseline. Yesterday, Ms. McGlashan asked that I develop a revised baseline based on some slightly different assumptions. Those assumptions are that the PERS employer rate will be 10.98% and health benefits, the growth in the cost of health benefits would be 9%, and that we incorporate the latest teacher, administrator, and classified staff salary forecasts into the baseline. We did that late yesterday, and what you see here on this first page is the result of that. It shows a new baseline level at $5.179 billion. The primary change in this from previous baseline is the health benefits assumption. The prior baseline assumed 12% growth per year, and this one assumes 9%. At this point, what I'd like to do is really discuss and try to make it more clear what the baseline is. The baseline is intended to reflect how much it would cost in 0305 to provide the same level of services that existed in the 2001 school year. To the extent that we can have true cost savings in the form of reduction in the PERS rate or lower health insurance costs, then the cost of providing that level of services comes down. You may recall that the prior baseline for model for 0305 projected a cost of $5.6 billion. This roughly $5.2 billion is a result of incorporating PERS savings, health insurance cost savings, and some revised salary forecasts. The salary forecast has been revised downward primarily to reflect the high level of retirements that we're seeing at the end of this year. What happens when a lot of teachers retire is that they are replaced with much lower salary teachers, and so your average salary tends to be held down when you have a lot of retirements. We're actually projecting that the average salary will decline next year relative to this year because of the very large number of retirements that we're seeing at the end of 0203.
Representative Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Those retirements will be reflected, I assume, in an increased PERS cost as people many people are taking early retirements and leaving the system as far as teaching is concerned. I assume you've factored those into the increased PERS cost from those retirements?
Chair Morgan, Representative Bates, the increased PERS costs are reflected in the PERS rate assumption. In terms of early retirement incentives that those teachers may be getting, those are also included in the model as well.
Thank you.
This may be a good place to have a very short discussion on why 10.98 was chosen as the PERS rate. Ms. McGlashan, can you talk a little bit about that? And Mr. Reeder, I know that you're very grounded in this issue also. As is Ms. Ames.
Madam Chair and members of the subcommittee, the information that we have from PERS as to what the rate might be after all the PERS legislation that has passed was originally 9.98%. And we won't know the actual rate until June 30th when the board is to set the rate for 0305. But there's been some indication that rather than the 9.98%, it will go up about a percentage point for the schools, I think, in part because of what Representative Bates was mentioning, the increased retirements, and that does affect the rate that needs to be set. So that's where we're getting the rate from, the initial estimates from PERS, and then just an estimate of what we think it might go up to based on the increased retirements. But we won't know the actual rate until June 30th.
Ms. Ames, do you have anything to add to this discussion? There also is discussion around whether this rate is going to hold or whether it's going to change. Can you talk to us about the parameters around that?
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, this is my understanding as of today, and that is that when the board sets the rate for the 0305 biennium, that regardless of what may happen in the courts, that rate that they set on June 30th will be the rate that stays in effect for the for the entire biennium. If there's any change in the rate as a result of a court decision, that would not be reflected until 0507 and beyond.
Thank you very much. Mr. Reed, I'm sorry to derail you there.
Chair Morgan, just a couple of other clarifications. Yesterday, I believe Mr. Sager mentioned that the governor's proposal of $5.3 billion, the key difference in the assumptions in that estimate versus the one in front of you here is the PERS rate. I believe the assumption in that, in the $5.3 billion estimate, was a PERS rate of 14%. If we were to put 14% in the model, the result would be $5.3 billion. So these two estimates are completely consistent with each other, the only difference being the assumption about what the PERS rate will actually be. And, I mean, as Ms. McLaughlin pointed out, we don't have a lot of certainty at this point on that. We're simply operating on the best information that we have at the time. And also, another clarification, there has been a number out there that the roll-up, the initial roll-up, was a number of $6 billion. And I mentioned earlier that the baseline of the QEM prior to these latest revisions was 5.6, and I've been asked, what's the difference between those two? The primary difference is that the roll-up, which came out of the school finance or the revenue forecast committee, was based on the original 0103 appropriation before any of the cuts we've experienced in the 0203 school year. And that appropriation was up fairly significantly from the level of funding in the prior biennium. So the QEM baseline is based on 2001, which is in that prior biennium. The roll up to $6 billion was based on essentially 1 year later at a higher level of funding. So that's the difference between those two. As I mentioned earlier, the baseline is always reflective of a particular point in time. And for the QEM, that point in time is 2001. For the $6 billion forecast from the Revenue Forecasting Committee, that point in time is 1 year later, essentially 0102. So that's the key difference there.
Mr. Reeder, for my own personal clarification, does the baseline, is it kind of a rolling, it reflects in a rolling way the actual costs as they become available and the roll-up on the actual costs?
Chair Morgan, as the Commission has developed the baseline, yes, that's exactly what it has been. Prior to this current baseline is based on 2001. The prior baseline was based on actually 2 years earlier, 98-99 data, and we didn't, simply because of the timing of the Quality Education Commission, we did not develop a baseline for 99-2000. We simply didn't have we had the 2001 data early enough that particular year that we simply went to that more recent data and didn't do a baseline for that interim year. It occurred to me in thinking about this over the past few days that it would be useful to develop a baseline for each year, simply to know where we what level of resources would be required in the model or would be reflected in the model of actual funding levels in each year.
I agree with you. I think that in terms of relative comparison, that it would be valuable to have a year-by-year baseline that reflect the rolling data.
Chair Morgan, I do believe that would be useful because the baseline is not in any way a target or a goal. It is simply a reflection of where we actually have been and what actually exists. And in that sense, it would be useful to have that in each year.
Representative Bates.
Madam Chair, thank you for the line of thinking as I'm having a hard time getting my hands around this thing. The 2001 figure you're using for your QEM baseline, is that what it would have cost to fully implement the QEM in 2001, or is it the actual funding that occurred in 2001?
Chair Morgan, Representative Bates, it's the actual level of funding that occurred in 2001.
I assume that's what it was. Could you at some time give us that actual figure on this, put on back on this chart?
I do have the amount of revenue that went out to school districts through the formula, which is really the basis on which the model is built for 2001, was $3.174 billion. And that includes local revenue as well. That's not just the state school fund, but that's local property taxes as well.
That's state and, Madam Chair? That's state and local?
Correct.
And that's what went into the K-12 system, so that excludes the ESDs.
Chair Morgan, that's correct. This is just K-12 districts.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordley.
Thank you. Committee members might want to also have in front of them, for a part of this discussion, the information that we received from Ozzie Rose, Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, responses to the survey of superintendents asking what funding level is required to restore their planned 2002-03 school year for 03-04. And by my count, there are 36 districts who have responded that they would need 5.6 or above in order to restore a school year.
Senator Gordley, I would again urge people to be very cautious about that because the assumptions that were used in the building to that number are not known to us. And the ones that I looked at that where they did outline the assumptions, they were very much on the high end of the scale. So just to put a little bit of perspective there. Mr. Reeder, we keep derailing you. Please continue.
Chair Morgan, members of the committee, if you look at the very last page of the handout, you see the key assumptions that go into the baseline estimate. And the key ones are at the very top, the assumptions about growth rates in teacher salaries, principal salaries, so forth. And as you can see in the baseline, we're assuming actually a decline in the average teacher salary of 0.2%. As I mentioned, that's driven primarily by the high retirements. And then in 04-05, we expect the number of retirements to decline dramatically from...
If I might just interject and derail you one more time. In teacher salaries, when you see a negative number there, that... What I'm trying to get my hands around is what that represents. That doesn't represent a rollback it represents a rollback in the total amount of dollars globally going into the K-12 system for salaries in the projection of that. But what it's fueled by in what I'm trying to grasp here is what it's fueled by is a differential in the amount of money needed
to pay for high-paying teachers that are retiring being replaced by lower-paid teachers that are coming into the system.
Chair Morgan, that's correct. It doesn't mean that any particular teacher is taking a pay cut. It simply means that over all teachers, the average has gone down because a lot of high-paid teachers have left the system and they have been replaced by lower-paid teachers. And when you take the average over that, it has gone down slightly.
And is that the only factor that's causing that to be a negative number, or are there other factors that are rolling that cost back?
Really, there are three primary factors that drive this average salary number. The first is the one we've been talking about, and that is turnover, high-paid teachers leaving and being replaced by low-paid teachers. The other two are cost of living increases that are negotiated and also step increases that are negotiated. The assumptions in here are typically we have assumed that cost of living increases would rise at roughly 80% of the consumer price index. But for 03-04 and 04-05, we have slightly altered that assumption, assuming that in negotiations that those COLAs would be smaller due to the current budget situation, that districts would be able to negotiate lower COLAs with their teachers than they would in better budget times. And then the step increases are based simply on an average of looking at the salary schedules of districts and saying how much does a teacher's salary go up when they move up a step on the salary scale. And that, we did not change the assumption on that. We have set that at roughly 2.5% per year, which is about where the average of steps are across districts in the state.
So if I might just reiterate to make sure that I'm getting this, then the factors that cover COLAs and step increases would cause the number to move into the positive range. The factor that governs the turnover rate, the higher paid teachers being replaced by lower paid teachers, would drive the number in the negative range.
Chair Morgan, that's correct. And as you can see in 03-04, that last effect more than offsets, the negative effect more than offsets the two positive effects, and we get a net negative for that particular year.
Senator Messer.
Thanks, Madam Chair. maybe I'm making some assumptions here. I shouldn't. If I go back one page where you're talking about district administrative support dollars per student.
How many pages in are you?
I'm one back from the last page where he's speaking.
Okay.
I'm curious as to the cost of $224 for each elementary, middle, and high school being the same. Maybe you could explain that to me.
Chair Morgan, Senator Messerly, in the QEM, the centralized activities that go on in a district, the superintendent's office, centralized curriculum planning, so forth, those are activities that don't occur in any particular school. And so in order to allocate those costs to the prototype schools, we simply do it on a per-student basis for all three prototypes, elementary, middle, and high. That's why they're the same for each school type.
Just a quick follow-up.
Chair.
So that's an assumption. Does that prove out to be an accurate assessment? It would seem to me that just because of numbers and the level of oversight, that number should be different.
Chair Morgan, Senator Messerly, because those are centralized costs, we don't, based on the financial data that we have really no way of knowing where the actual, if a district actually spends more on centralized costs on their elementary than they do on their high school, we can't discern that from the data that we have.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Bates.
Yeah, it's a couple questions. I'm getting lost here in the data, which doesn't take much, I'm afraid. In computing this drop in teacher, I guess, salary forecasting model, did you include in that anywhere what's going to cost the districts for those early retirement people from the point of view of whether they buy them health care benefits until they get reach 65? Did you compute in there the PERS benefit from the point of view that I have one piece of information indicating that the PERS benefit for teachers may be actually higher than the state average of 10.98. Has there been any discussion about that at all?
Chair Morgan, Representative Bates, the PERS rate that we're using here is for schools. It is different than for state employees, and it is the same for all school districts. They are in a pool.
But it is higher than generally for state employees, is my understanding.
Difference of some kind.
Chair Morgan, I believe...
Sames is approaching the bench here.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Linda Ames with the Department of Administrative Services. Actually, after all the reforms with the fiscal impacts we had on what all those bills would do to the rates, it looked like state agency, that the pool that has state agency workers in it is around 15% rate.
Oh, interesting.
And schools was around 10. Now, both of those may go up slightly when we get the final numbers on June 30th. If you look at where the rates were, I believe the school rate was higher before any of the reductions for reform, but however the demographics work, the reforms reduced the school rate more than it reduced the state government rate. And I couldn't begin to explain why that would be the case.
Well, dedicate a whole session of this committee just to try to unravel that one. So I'm not sure if there's any relevance going there. I think we just need to work with the operative number that our brain trust gives us to work with.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'd ask to ask, not now, to have a quick discussion with me afterwards, because I am still confused about this. And just for the record, I want to know that I'm a little concerned that 10.98 may not be the number. And we won't know until June 30th, but I'm a little concerned, and I want that for the record, right? Okay? Because that affects all the rest of these calculations big time.
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, I think the idea is that we sort of have a placeholder right now and that no one is really thinking about making a final decision until we really know what the rate is.
Mm-hmm. And you also had a question relative to health benefits.
Chair Morgan, Representative Bates, as with PERS, the assumption about health benefits here at 9% is, I mean, we're not going to know what that actual increase is. This 9% in some way assumes some sort of change in practice, some savings, perhaps from the proposed, the acronym is escaping me at the moment, but a PEB-like system, centralized provider of insurance for school employees that can achieve some savings through more effective purchasing of insurance and also reduced administrative costs. This number is also a bit soft at the moment. But you did have a further question about whether these retirees will result in additional costs because of providing, you know, health benefits after they retire and so forth. The model does pick that up as part of its standard calculations.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Please proceed, Mr. Reeder.
At this point, I think I would like to talk about the impact scenario that we generated last night, and I believe Ms. McClashen has passed that out. It's a single page, front and back, and maybe we...
Did the committee meet last night?
No.
Oh, good.
The committee did not meet last night without your representative.
Well, I blew off the meeting.
The department and LFO and BAM have been doing an incredible amount of work on trying to deal with rational, realistic assumptions here and factoring those into the model. And I wanted to go on record as saying that this has been an extraordinary undertaking by these folks who have put in a lot of hours, and it's a really good example of state agencies cooperating with each other and putting a product out that I think is going to have a very big impact on moving the discussion along in the appropriate level of funding in the state school fund. With that,
Chair Morgan, I would like to point out that when you mentioned rational assumptions, Frank McNamara said that sounds like something new for the department. And I'll simply respond to that by saying, ouch.
Oh, that was so dry. I think I need some moisturizer.
If we start on the, I think if we start on the back page, it'll be a little bit better here. If you look at the assumptions that are highlighted on the back page, for salaries, this scenario is based on the assumption that districts would be able to negotiate salary freezes with all their employees, essentially no step increases, no COLAs. And what that does with the high level of turnover we've seen due to retirements, it really drives the average salary down even further. Instead of minus 0.2%, we're at minus 4.2%, and that's a fairly dramatic decline in the average salary.
So the only adjustments here are for the higher paid teachers going out and lower paid teachers coming in. There's no adjustment for COLA or salary increases.
That's correct. It assumes that that teachers are given no COLAs and that no step increases are granted, so that the only effect is turnover. And then, that's right, every district would be able to achieve this for the 03-04 school year, essentially right away.
I'm curious here if has there been no factor applied for the high paid out, low paid in principals, assistants, principals, and classifieds and substitute teachers, or has it been applied and it has no impact?
Chair Morgan, we have not applied that to those employees because it's particularly for superintendents, but also I think for principals, they are not on the same sort of salary schedule that teachers are. So, you know, potentially when a superintendent retires and a new one is hired, they could be hired at a higher salary. And the same with a principal. So we really don't have the good data or the consistency of that sort of phenomenon that we see for teachers. So we don't have any good way of estimating turnover for those categories. So we simply don't try to do that. So we set those at zero. In this scenario, we assume that no salary increases for all those other classes simply results in a zero change.
Sure.
Representative Bates.
I made a little statement there, kind of slipped in. I want to make sure I heard it properly. Teacher salaries, you said this is the kind of reduction in salaries every district can expect, but I don't think every district can expect that. Some will have more retirements, some less retirements. It'll vary district to district. And I'm not sure you can assume that for every district. If I heard you say that properly, I mean, I'm going pretty fast.
That's an assumption.
Chair Morgan, Representative Bates, that's correct. These are assumptions which may or may not come true.
It would vary from district to district.
Clearly, it would vary from district to district. But in order to achieve this particular assumption, you know, in evaluating whether it's reasonable or not, you would have to take that into account. But this assumption does assume that every district would be able to freeze their salaries. completely. There's a, in talking about assumptions, there are sort of two classes of assumptions, those that you hope will come true and those that you actually think will come true. And so it's important to keep that in mind when we're talking about the assumptions in the model here.
Senator Masely.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Along that same line, again, on the districts that are losing enrollment and are downsizing, they're going to be losing, through seniority, the low-end teachers as opposed, yes, they might have some retirements, but they're also reducing the starting teachers as well, which I would think would throw this model off.
Chair Morgan, Senator Meserle, the model that forecasts salaries takes into account the total number of teachers in the system. So to the extent that enrollment, the total level of enrollment in the state is growing slowly because some districts are growing and others are declining, the model would reflect the fact that some low paid teachers would be exiting the system. So it does take that into account.
Please proceed.
If you now flip to the front page to look at the impact of this assumption of no salary increases, you can see that if those assumptions were to come true, it would save $236 million over the biennium, so that the state school fund requirement would fall from roughly $5.2 billion down to $4.9 billion. Just point out that this kind of analysis is really what the QEM is very good at. It is able to take into account all of those factors that influence the cost when certain things happen in the system. And so it really, the model as a tool to evaluate these kinds of impacts is really one of its primary and most useful activities.
Representative Bates.
I don't want to derail this thing. I just want to keep myself tracking on this thing.
Uh-huh.
In 2001, the QEM model, not fully implemented, was $3,174 million. Looking at a QEM model for 2003-05 biennium of $5 billion, and yet if you just take and double the 2001 for 1 year, you come up with $6.3 billion. I am not tracking this at all. Where we're going with this discussion, I just can't relate what we're doing in 2001 to what we're doing in 2003 and see that big a change.
Who wants to take this one, Ms. Ames?
I mean, I'm just out there. I don't know.
Mr. Glashen?
I don't get it.
Madam Chair, I believe
I think we're in an apples and oranges
situation. Number Representative Bates threw out was probably total state school fund that Brian gave him earlier. Is that
mm-hmm.
correct? The three
state and local.
I believe that was for a single year,
and
these are state-only funds for a biennium, for 2 years.
So perhaps, Representative Bates, what would work for you
is to get relevant
years for single years or for bienniums.
I think Representative Bates the QEM from South 101 Education, and I'll do that outside the committee.
Chair Morgan, Representative Bates, it may be useful for us to put together a table that shows state school fund amounts plus local revenue amounts and total amounts for different years and different assumptions so that we have all those numbers on a single page so it becomes clearer how they differ.
Thank you.
Madam Chair. Senator Gorley.
Thank you. And could you talk to us again about how we should consider the funding for low-incidence, high-cost special education students, which is shown here as zeros, because...
Chair Morgan, Senator Gordley, the zero shown here reflects a special fund that the Quality Ed Commission recommended be set up to pay for the cost of serving those students. It doesn't mean that those students aren't being served. They are currently being served with funds coming from the allocation that districts get through the state school fund. So they're not set aside in a separate fund. The full QEM model recommends that that fund have roughly $60 million put in it for the 03-05 biennium, which would take the pressure off the general fund of school districts because of the high cost of those students. As you know, Senate Bill 550 sets up such a fund. So if that bill is to pass, then the next round of the baseline would have some money in that fund.
Mr. Reeder, I want to go through and just make sure that I'm on bead with the list of assumptions for growth rates and contribution rates and enrollments. And so what I'm doing is comparing the 4.9 policy scenario with the assumptions in the revised baseline.
Okay.
And what I'm looking at, I'm curious, it appears that in both of these, that there is a growth rate for substitute teacher pay. Am I correct in that?
Chair Morgan, that's correct. Under current statute, the rate for substitute teachers is based on the salary schedules of districts in the prior year. Therefore, it's not influenced by
negotiations
to any great extent. It's based on a bachelor's degree with no experience. It also is not influenced by turnover at all.
And Madam Chair, it is established in statute.
Yeah.
And it was a bill that you adopted earlier in this session raising that. It's an area that you might have controlled at a zero rate.
Okay. And so that would be the same in both the scenarios. The assumption is for the statutory level of funding to be that the increase will be the statutory level of increase.
Chair Morgan, that's correct. We last night in doing these runs, we did put zero in there simply to see how much it would impact it, and it's roughly $2 million for the biennium, so it's extremely small.
And then in the health insurance, the assumption is, again, a growth rate that would reflect a PEB-like situation evolving in the K-12 system also. And then you get down to computer hardware and software, and the assumption here is that in both of the models, that there will be no funding put into, and is this a replacement of, or what does this reflect?
Chair Morgan, this is simply a growth rate, so it doesn't mean there's no funding there. It means the funding is not increasing over time, and that
okay.
The zero growth rate reflects sort of the market for computers. They just keep getting cheaper, more powerful and cheaper all the time, and so our assumption here is that they don't, the amount spent doesn't increase over time.
Okay.
They are spending money, but it's not growing.
There is in both of the assumptions a 2.7% growth rate in 0405 and a 2.8% growth rate in 0304 on computer networks. And can you talk to us about why that one was included in both of the assumptions and where this goes?
Chair Morgan, as you can see, the growth rates assumed in a lot of these items down here are the same. The assumption in the model is that the growth in a lot of these activities reflects inflation, and so we use the implicit price deflator as a measure of inflation in this, and that's consistent with the inflation assumptions made by the Revenue Forecast Committee. Computer network activity is much less related to hardware and software than it is to personnel actually maintaining networks. So that's really an assumption about growth in the salaries paid to the district's network people who keep the network running.
And those may or may not be ESD folks, or, I mean, would those be subcontracts in most cases outside of the K-12 system?
Chair Morgan, it'll be a real mix. Larger districts have their own people. Smaller districts would contract out much of this kind of activity. Some of them would have it provided by their ESDs.
So there may be room then to adjust down the inflationary costs reflected in no salary increases? And that's a question, not a statement.
Representative Morgan, that's correct. To the extent that they're embedded in a lot of these activities down here are staff time, and many of those expenses are, or some of those expenses would be compensation of staff. The assumption of no growth in salaries would tend to hold those down as well. The model does not pick that up as currently designed.
And then with textbooks, this assumes a straight across 8% inflation rate in textbook prices. Is that what this is all about?
Chair Morgan, that's correct. I have had discussions with, and I don't remember the name of the company, Northwest Textbook Depository, which is of the vendor that sells the bulk of textbooks to Oregon school districts, and their anticipation was growth in textbook prices of roughly 8% a year in the foreseeable future. Textbooks have been growing in price fairly dramatically in recent years.
Okay. Then the next one is classroom materials and equipment, and it has a 2.81 and a 2.74 inflation factor in both of these. Can you talk to us about what this is covering?
Chair Morgan, that would be things like paper, and I'm thinking more about an elementary school, just the supplies that teachers use to do various classroom activities.
So this is like the things they put on the walls and the activities that they hand out to the kids and
That's correct.
All the consumables.
That's correct.
Okay. And then copying, you've got 2.81 and 2.74 as the inflation rates in both of the assumptions. And what is that? That's copying of materials that are handed out in the classroom?
Chair Morgan, that's correct. I mean, copying of classroom assignments, copying of items that schools send home to parents with students, any sort of copying that districts do in their central office or for classroom activities or for sending them home.
And so this is somehow the cost of the copying that's done and handed out in the classroom. But what I'm curious about is there any slop over here in how you're accounting? Because if you've got classroom materials above, and I would imagine from my experience in schools that a fair amount of this are worksheets that the teachers hand out to the students. So is there a differentiation with the copying costs that relate to classroom handout materials and other copying costs?
Chair Morgan, I don't believe there is. We do have in the expenditure data that we receive from districts, both of those items are separate categories. So we're assuming that if it's copying, they're putting it in one category or the other, but not both.
Okay. And then we've got media center materials. What's that one all about?
Chair Morgan, that would be things like videos that they use for instructional purposes, typically the things that you might find in a school library that are that they purchase. It would include, actually it would not be just limited to video type. It would include books that they purchase, periodicals for the library.
So everything that would be in what we used to call a library and now we call them media centers.
That's correct. We don't have libraries anymore. We have media centers.
Okay. And then did you have a question, Representative?
Madam Chair, just real quickly, and having worked with very confusing school budgets, what would help in this discussion for me is I know the top five or six issues here are about 85 to 90% of the budgets for this district's I wouldn't mind seeing a breakdown of what these other things actually cost.
As a percentage of the total budget.
Because that's what's really important. Right.
The weight factor.
Yeah, and so you're looking at 6-8% in one area, which books always drove me crazy, but the real ones are up on top, and that's where the real ones, so to speak. It's like, you know, if you're going to rob the bank, you want some money, you're going to rob the bank, because that's where the money is, which we, I like to see us focus more on those top ones.
Yeah. Is it possible to do that, Mr. Reeder, to just associate a percentage of total spending to each of these line items?
Chair Morgan, yes, I do have that data.
Thank you. That's
the data that we have in the database initiative.
And, Madam Chair, if I might add, you could also run the model with these factors and then at zero to see what the effect of including the factors.
That's a good point.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, talk to us about professional development programs and materials, what this one is.
Chair Morgan, the model has includes a component which we call professional development, and we express it as number of days provided to staff. And then based on data from the database initiative, we know how much districts spend on those activities, and they would be bringing in a trainer or purchasing materials
for the training,
training for new materials, so forth. So it would be a mix of, you know, hiring trainers or purchasing materials, sending teachers to classes, that sort of activity.
So then, in the staff cost increase, this is not got anything to do with base pay. This just has to do with any cost that would be over and above the base pay involved in teacher training?
Chair Morgan, that's correct. These are not amounts that are paid to teachers at all. They are amounts paid by districts to provide training to teachers.
But would, for example, if a teacher had to go somewhere to take part in training, would that cost be part of this?
Yes, it would.
Okay. And then food services.
Most districts provide some level of food service for their students, and those activities often generate revenue, but typically they don't generate enough to cover all their costs. So the model incorporates that difference, the shortfall of their costs relative to their revenues from selling school lunches, and we assume that increases over time.
And so this is the inflationary factor built into those losses?
That's correct.
Okay. And student transportation, this is busing.
That's correct.
These are the inflation factors built into the cost of the busing, I'm assuming. 30%. Technology services.
Chair Morgan, again, this is related to activities, typically computer networks, and these would be, when it mentions services, typically it's services purchased from private vendors that would be related in some way to technology, typically computers or audiovisual equipment, software licenses, to the extent that they're not picked up in the software category shown above. Again, these categories are separate categories in the database initiative, and so if a district is reporting expenditures in one, then they're not reporting it in the other. So we don't have a situation here where we may be double counting any of these expenses. They're simply slightly different types of activities that have been categorized in different ways.
Okay. And then operations and maintenance?
The operations and maintenance category is actually quite a large category. The spending, this is for maintaining buildings, repair of buildings, maintenance such as janitorial activities. It also includes the purchase of energy for heating buildings, electricity, lighting, water, all the activities and items that go into keeping the building itself running.
So this is electricity and like garbage service and all the things that we as homeowners pay are also included in this category?
That's correct. Typically, this averages on the order of $600 to $700 per student in most districts. It's a major spending category for most districts.
Wow.
That includes maintaining the building. Hmm? It should include maintaining the buildings.
Right. Yeah.
I assume that, Madam Chair, I assume that that means maintaining the buildings too.
That's correct.
Painting and construction and repairs and.
Chair Morgan and Representative Bates, it would include all those activities. It would not include any major capital improvements, but typically ongoing maintenance, you know, like any homeowner would do on their home. It would include occasional painting, repairing the plumbing and electricity and so forth.
I would point out, Madam Chair, that the stuff we do in our home is one thing. What you have to do inside schools with kids in there is a little different. Yes. Maintaining the plumbing and the painting and the rest of it is quite expensive. I guess, you know, this kind of kids running around. Those kids run through my place, my expenses go up a lot.
The other support services, I'm assuming, is just a catch-all category for things that weren't easily categorized in the other expense category.
That's correct.
The centralized special education, can you talk to us about what this one is?
That would be expenses at the district level. When the term centralized in the model indicates spending at the district level, not at a particular school. So this would be activities that a district would do to serve special ed students. It may be transportation costs for special ed, although that should be picked up in the transportation category. But any activities that districts do to aid special ed students that really are district-wide activities as opposed to activities in a particular school.
Then the district and ESD administration. Oh, wait a minute. I missed one. Centralized curriculum development and assessment.
That typically would include all of the assessment activities or the bulk of the assessment activities in administering tests and so forth, which are, for most districts, are recorded as district-wide expenses rather than expenses that occur in a particular school.
Okay. And what would be cost increase issues here? What would be inflationary issues here?
Representative Morgan, again, it would a piece of it would involve staff time. So in that sense, in a scenario where we're assuming no salary increases, this assumption probably needs to be reduced a bit. But it would include purchasing of materials, copying, that sort of thing, any of those activities involved with administering assessments.
So would, with centralized special education, would there also be a realistic discussion to have there around, I guess what I'm getting at is what proportion of that would be salaries that would be subject to a freeze too?
Chair Morgan, I believe it, I mean, if we don't, well, we could, let me back up. We do have data in the database initiative that would look at that function and say how much of the spending on that function is salaries. So I think we do have the data to break that out. And I anticipate it's probably roughly in the same proportion as all salaries are to total costs, roughly in the ballpark of
80%. So when you have this schedule of growth rates for these expenses, the piece inside of each of these line items that's related to salary isn't linked to the salary increase piece of it, so it doesn't automatically adjust?
Chair Morgan, last year, late in the process of finalizing the quality ed model revisions, I did go into the model and tie the salary assumptions to certain centralized activities. And I would have to go back and look at the model to know whether I did it for all of these activities or just certain ones. And I'm not remembering precisely whether I did it for all of them or not. If I did do it, it would not show up as a change to this assumption. It would make the adjustment elsewhere in the model.
Okay. Would it be possible for you to add that to your list of things
certainly.
To do?
And Madam Chair?
Senator Gordley.
Thank you. I don't understand why there's no growth in the centralized special education. I don't understand how there could not be a growth rate.
Chair Morgan, Senator Gordley, I believe the growth rate is 6.2% for centralized special education.
Why it doesn't change is what I'm asking. Why it stays the same for each of the...
Why the inflationary increase doesn't change. Get larger over time?
Well, it does.
Yeah, five more
kids. Because you have 1 year at 6.8, and then the next year it's increased by 6.8, and then the next year...
Am I looking at the wrong number? I see 6.8.
Right, each year.
Yeah.
These are growth rates.
It's not increasing, but there is an increase each year.
But I think, Senator Gordley, that your question actually is in the line above it, that inflationary rate does increase or change. Mm-hmm. And so is your question, why is the centralized special education number the same all the way across?
That's when the asked. Other... That's what I asked.
Chair Morgan, Senator Gordley, the best information that we have, these growth rate assumptions are based on historical data in the growth in per student spending on special education, and that data suggests that a growth rate of 6.2% per year is appropriate. This doesn't mean that spending is not increasing. It is increasing every year, and it's mm-hmm. increasing by 6.2%. every year. If we think that those costs are accelerating, the constant growth rate assumption means they're going up like this. If we think they're really going up like this, mm-hmm. then a different assumption would be appropriate. But based on historical data, this is the best information I have.
Talk to us about the district ESD administration category. What costs are covered there?
Chair Morgan, those costs would be typically the office of the superintendent for a district, and similarly the office of the superintendent of an ESD.
So, again, would there be a reasonable grounds to have a discussion here about the rate of increase in inflation related to no salary increases?
Chair Morgan, I believe there would, and I will check to see if that change, whether in fact I made that change to the model or not for all of these categories.
Okay. PERS employer contribution rate. Does this reflects just the assessment? It doesn't have anything to... Does this include also the 6% employee contribution?
Chair Morgan, no, it does not include the 6%. We have always treated the 6% pickup as salary. We consider that to be teachers.
So it's accounted for in the salary line?
That's correct.
Okay. And then talk to us about early retirement incentive payment rate.
Do I have to?
Only if you're retiring.
You're not retiring.
Oh, I'm retiring. That's right. Kind of backwards. Thank you, Madam Chair.
A number of districts put in place, and typically these were put in place quite a few years ago, incentives for teachers to retire early, and I believe there was...
This is in addition to PERS, I take it.
That's correct. I believe there were sort of two reasons that districts did that. The first was that they believed there were cost savings to be had by replacing longtime teachers with new teachers that would more than offset these incentive payments. And I also think I've been told that there was a time in a number of districts, and this may be true primarily in declining enrollment districts, where their need for teachers was declining, and that this was a way for them to reduce their staff without actually having to lay off teachers. They would provide an incentive for teachers to retire early and would reduce their staffs in that manner. Typically, these payments go for up to 5 years, and they are, you know, a fixed dollar amount per month for a set period of time. What we've done, we do have data, specific data on this that we gather through the database initiative that shows how much each district pays for those, and what I've attempted to do for the model is to convert that to a annual per teacher, or convert to an annual amount that is expressed as dollars per active teacher, so that it's based on the number of teachers that currently exist in the system, as opposed to trying to tie it to those who have retired.
So you can pull it back in and add it to the total amount of dollars that's needed to run the system.
That's correct.
And what is the 2% inflation rate? Is that a built-in COLA in the program?
Chair Morgan, I believe that is simply an assumption we made that over time, as those are granted, they will have to be, really they track salaries in some sense. So if a teacher takes advantage of an early retirement program, that amount will be based in some way on their final salary. And as salaries climb over time, that those incentive payments would also climb along with them.
Madam Chair?
Senator Masterly.
Am I reading this totally wrong then? Because the comment is that this is a 2% percentage of the active teacher's salary then, as opposed to the total teachers? I was thinking of it in terms of the total salaries in the district. That's not true then.
Well, bear in mind, Senator, that this is a chart of growth assumption rates.
Chair Morgan, this section actually is under contribution rates. These are not growth rates. These are shares of some amount, and in this case, they are, in this case, 2% of the salaries of active teachers.
Ah, okay. So this isn't an inflation rate. This is a straight across, an assessment of the total teacher salaries.
Correct. I misspoke earlier when I spoke about it as a growth rate. It is a share of active teacher salaries that is paid out to teachers who retired early. The reason that it doesn't go down, or it would not really be influenced in the short run by a different assumption about salaries, is that most of those are in place already. I mean, there are teachers who've retired 2 or 3 years ago, and that any change in current teacher salaries would have no impact on the obligation of districts to make those payments.
What is the impact that is going to be caused by the number of teachers that are going to retire because of PERS benefit issues before they're actually slated to retire, if that issue wasn't the way that it is?
Chair Morgan, to the extent that some of those teachers would qualify for these retirement incentives, we may see this amount jump up a little bit.
Madam Chair?
We don't have really trying to anticipate where this is going over time is difficult because districts are trying to get rid of these things in their negotiations, and some of them are having success and some of them aren't.
Okay, but there is a potential for a teacher to retire early because of a consideration for PERS benefits and be eligible to receive an early retirement benefit on top of that?
Potentially.
Senator Masaryk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I thought I heard you say, Mr. Reeder, that you have this information available on a per-district basis. I don't know how easy that is to make that available to us, but it's been my understanding that districts have been trying to get rid of this program for many, many years because they realized it was costing them a lot of money. I would be very interested to know which districts are retaining early retirement programs.
I can provide that information.
Representative Bates.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I believe, and I may be wrong about this, there are basically two types of early retirement programs. I'm somewhat shocked that it's grown to, if I'm reading this right, to 2% of total. Is that 2% of total teacher salaries for the state is roughly what it costs us now?
That's correct.
Okay. Having got that figure in my mind, I'm stunned by that figure, frankly. Many districts have used early retirement incentive payments for two purposes that are really quite good for the districts. One is if they were not automatic, they were ones that were negotiated on an individual basis and allowed districts in a cost-effective way to trim their staff with the most high-cost teachers. It was cheaper to give them a small bump in their retirement as their need for teachers decreased because of decreasing in population of students. So it was a very good tool for some districts to use. An automatic early retirement plan was with a bump in pay is something different, and that's a differentiation I'd like to see. It was also used at times when there were reasons for a teacher to leave a district and the district wanted that teacher to leave, that these kind of incentives were used because it was cheaper to use a little bit of an incentive, pay some medical benefits and have that teacher agree to leave than to go through a process which would commonly cost district $60,000 to $100,000 to go through a complete process of removing a teacher. So these are some administrative tools involved in this, but I'm hoping we're not talking about those. We're talking about sort of a flat retirement plans that were set up that would allow teachers to retire early with an automatic bump in their pay, irregardless of things I've just talked about. I'd like to see a differentiation between those if we could.
Chair Morgan, Representative Bates, we don't have information on what type of programs these are. We simply have the amounts that districts pay as part of those programs. So based on the financial data we have, we really can't distinguish those.
Representative March.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Basically, the QAM model, as you've outlined it, is a what-if model in your assumptions. And do we have any analysis of the risk that you're using in the assumptions, i.e., high likelihood that this factor is the correct factor, or it's within a range, that sort of thing? For example, the PERS number, I've heard a lot of different numbers on that. So what is the risk that 10.98, and if that's a placeholder, I don't know why you did the precision of two decimals, but or actually four decimals, that would be something interested in. And for your teacher salary forecasting model is another. What are the assumptions? There's assumptions built into that, and what are the likelihood or risks of these numbers being different would be one thing. And then could we get an update on the comment section? Because I notice principal salaries at zero assumption based on past trends is not the real assumption. It's based on freezing the salary at zero. And the assumption, for example, of health insurance at 9% is not assumption based on past trends, but it's based on adopting a PEB-like system. So I'd like to see what the real comment is there, and this was printed out. I know it's done in a hurry and based on comments on a previous iteration, but at some point, if we could get what the real assumption is based on and what if there is some way of assessing risk of the assumption numbers would be helpful information for me to know.
Chair Morgan, Representative March, I apologize for not updating that comments column. That's something that really does need to be done. In terms of assessing risk, in terms of the teacher salary forecast, the model we have that does that has performed quite well in the last couple of years. We've been able to predict actual average salary quite well. We're moving, though, into times that are unusual. The level of retirements that we've seen this year is unprecedented. There certainly is more risk now that our forecasts of teacher salaries are not as close as they have been in the past. In terms of assessing the risk of assumptions like PERS, I'm open to anybody who can assess what the courts are going to do on that one. I'd like to hear about that. Maybe Ms. McGlashan has some insights on that, but I don't.
We did, Representative March, and I don't know if you were here or not, had a discussion, a fairly detailed discussion on the PERS assumption. And I think we're all eagerly awaiting the deliberation of the PERS board at the end of the month. But the point was also made that when that percentage is announced, that it will be in place for the whole biennium. And if there are adjustments to be made as a result of the court adjudications on the bills that we passed, it will be in the outlying years, not in the current biennium.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordley.
Thank you. I'm going to need to leave to go carry the first order of business, and I'll try to get back. We've not heard from Mr. Sager
at all. Body language.
But I'm feeling that he has something to say, and hope that if you have something that we need to get on to the record today, that you'll just pipe right up and put it out there for us.
Thank you. And good luck, Senator Gordley. I'd be very interested in knowing how the Senate does with the bill. I had the honor of carrying it yesterday. What I think it would be appropriate to do now, if there are no more questions or information that the committee members would like to have on the contents of the growth rate and the contribution rate line items, what we've been charged to do by the leadership committee is to have a discussion about the assumptions and put together what we feel are some reasonable sets of assumptions, and then to have the LFO run those through the model with the assistance of the department. So we need to begin a discussion right now of where we're going to go with our assumptions.
Madam Chair?
Senator Mazzardi.
This might be really a dumb question, but I've got three different data sheets here in front of me. And can I assume that the latest run is the most reliable or the most likely baseline that we can operate off of? I mean, I'm adding on to what Representative March said. How do they fit together, and what does this mean to us?
Madam Chair, if I
help you,
might just comment that the two handouts that you got today, as Brian mentioned earlier, have been updated for some assumptions. So to the extent that those assumptions hold true, like with the PERS rate, the health benefits growth at 9%, for example, then I suppose you could consider these reliable. But to the extent that those are going to, for example, the PERS rate is going to change, or the actual experience by the districts with their health benefits is not at 9%, then they're not reliable. But it does get down to, you know, what you think are the best assumptions to make, and that's one of the primary reasons that the subcommittee is meeting, and I think Brian may have some.
And Chair Morgan, what I would say is the two that you received today, the other difference is that we late yesterday afternoon updated the salary forecast to be fully consistent with the latest data that we have. So in that sense, the two that you received today are the most up-to-date in terms of the actual data that is used in the model. So I would use those as a starting point. And as Ms. McClatchin said, the other differences are simply based on assumptions, which is what you'll be considering.
Madam Chair, for the record, James Sager, Governor's Office. I do want to address Representative Marsh's question about the assumptions, because I am concerned that you understand that even if both the House and the Senate pass the insurance pooling bills that exist, that they will not begin to phase in even until the second half of this biennium. And so even if we were successful at getting all the districts in at 9%, it won't be till next biennium. So you have to decide whether you're going to use an assumption based on some criteria that you've established for yourself and you've said 9%, or are you going to base it on what we know is the trending for school districts, which the insurance rates are raising anywhere from about 11.5% to 17.5% in that range. So those are some, again, getting back to these various assumptions that exist that definitely we need to consider as you think about the impact of the schools. And
there,
Madam Chair,
also, I would imagine, is a factor that needs to be considered in that many of the districts have caps in the amount that they are paying for their portion of the health insurance coverage.
Madam Chair.
So the growth rates may not reflect the actual growth rate in the cost of the coverage.
Madam Chair, you're right. The total percentage increase may affect the district cap may increase by that percentage, or the district cap may be a set dollar amount, and all those variables are different. And Madam Chair, if you don't mind, if I could have just 30 seconds to mention two other documents that I provided the committee this morning. Senator Gordley had asked yesterday for information breaking out the baseline of achievement level that we have in the state, and so they're being passed around right now.
Yeah.
Thank you, Sue. Got from the department the baseline material that was provided to the U.S. Department of Education for approval of our No Child Left Behind plan and projections. Because you'll see it's broken down, it's disaggregated by the groups of students that we need to track, and that every school is responsible for having growth in each of these group. So it's not an aggregate score. We have to disaggregate each of these scores. And every district, virtually every school, is held accountable for each of these subgroups to make gains. So when we're talking about the QEM baseline, as we've talked about it today, that's providing the service level that, in essence, gave us this achievement level. Now we have, as you'll see in this document, committed, because of federal mandate, that we have to improve the achievement level of each of the subgroups, and thus, clearly, I don't think we can deny the fact that there's a cost to increasing the achievement of each of these groups. Having just come from my principalship 4 months ago, I know how that impacts a K-8 building, and having my third, fifth, and eighth graders, and now third through eighth graders, responsible for each of these subcategories making adequate yearly progress is going to be a challenge, and to assume that I could do that providing the exact same service level to the students as we had this past year, I don't think would be possible. On the bright side, I also wanted to include the press release that was sent out by Superintendent Castile and the governor announcing the NAEP National Report Card that was just released this morning at 9 o'clock, which shows that at the fourth grade level, we only have five states whose reading scores have any significant or anywhere significantly higher than our fourth graders. And at the eighth grade level, there are no states that are significantly higher. You couple that with the fact that we've consistently had the highest SAT scores in the country, and it shows that we have set high standards, which is what various organizations that have reviewed our standards have reinforced for us, but also we've been doing a very good job. But if we're going to continue that trend, we have to meet the obligation that we've set forth, No Child Left Behind, to increase the rate, and that's going to have an effect on the cost for the schools. Thank you.
Well, it would be very fortuitous if Doonesbury would do some cartoons about our...
I would appreciate those, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Senator Masurly.
I would really question the accuracy of this report because it looks to me like the male intelligence is being impugned in most areas pretty extensively.
Madam Chair, Ron Wilson, OSBA Director of Human Resource Development. On the assumption of a 9% growth on health care costs, just based on a historical trend of school district contributions, a 9% increase in the district contributions towards insurance is a very reasonable offer. I need to make the observation that an 11 or 17% growth rate on premiums is not the same as a growth rate on district contributions towards those.
Oh, thank
and because
you.
Of caps and other arrangements, the 9% estimate, irrespective of if you adopt a PEB-like structure, is a very reasonable, if not a little high, estimate of how those contribution rates have actually increased from year to year. And I can provide the committee some data to that regard.
Thank you very much. We have a problem here where our committee members are carrying bills on the floor, so we're going to have some in and out going on here. But I would like to involve the members of the committee that are here in some assumptions. What I'd like to do before we go down through the list is talk about the base level of funding. And Ms. McGlashan, can you talk to us, or perhaps Mr. Reeder also, do both of the... both the revised baseline and the policy scenarios that we have here reflect the same beginning point in funding. And what is it?
Madam Chair, with the two scenarios you have in front of you, I think Brian's talked about how the 0001 baseline is used, and so you would have consistency there. Where you don't have consistency is in the actual funding that the school districts wound up with for the 02-03 school year, and that base being used as the starting point for rolling forward with the current service calculation for 03-05. And with the work that Linda and I have done in looking at that base versus what's in the 0001 year, we believe you'd need to add back some dollars to the 0203 base to arrive at the same starting point, in other words, the same program level that you had in 0001.
And what is your estimate on how much would be needed?
Well, Linda might want to go into more detail about the approach that she took to determine the funding level, but we took a couple of different approaches and we both came up with about I think it was about $60 million that you would, about half of what they had cut as a result of Measure 28 and the $20 million from the veto back after the third special session. There was about $115 million cut. And we believe about half of that would need to be added back to get you to the same program level that you had in 0001. And then, of course, that's all affected, too, by what assumptions you're making in this model and also the CSL development. But
what was that add back amount?
About $60 million is what we...
16?
60. 60.
In terms of one of the things that is a huge discussion point in Ways and Means as a whole is in treating all of the budgets equitably and beginning the discussion on the 03-05 budgeting level from the same position, regardless of which agency we're talking about. If we were to start with the premise that the state school fund would be treated no differently than any other of the budgets that the entire process is taking a look at, what would we be looking at?
Madam Chair, and I don't know that I'm prepared to answer that question in terms of the material that I brought with me, but are you talking in terms of a funding level?
A beginning funding, a funding level that we would start the discussion at that kept us in conformance with the treatment that we have given all of the other agencies.
Well, Madam Chair, when we build the current service level budget, what we do is we start out with, started out with the 02-03 school year, and we look at the total formula dollars. So we don't just look at the state funding, because then we applied certain factors to build the current service level budget, and then look at what the local revenues are that are available in 03-05 and back that out and come out with what's required in state support.
Okay.
So the base that was used for 02-03, and Linda, correct me if I misspeak, but I believe it was $3,522,000,000. Is that correct?
Okay. And then, and that was close of session, or was that at the same place that we started the deliberations on all the other budgets?
That was after the special session reductions that were to be considered permanent. So it would be like the 112 million, the 20 million, the 95. It doesn't include the allotment reduction of 46.2 million.
But, and it does that number include local funding? Include,
yes,
property
it does.
Tax funding?
It include, that is the formula revenue.
3.5
billion.
Billion. Okay. So if we were going to be consistent across all of the budgets, this would be the place to start.
That's correct.
Okay, now why are you talking about starting 60 million higher than that?
Well, Madam Chair, if you... this is the approach that I took, and then Linda could speak to the approach that she took, and I think we pretty much wound up at the same place. But if you take that as your beginning funding level to build the 03-05 budget, by the time you apply the certain growth factors, you wind up with a level that, if you then feed that level into the quality education model, you find that it results in a cut in days. So if you want to get back to the 0001 baseline, where presumably you had a full school year, you would need to add that $60 million back to the base so that you get your full school year.
So, let me just seek further clarification then. So what you're saying is if I started with and put a $3.522 billion number in the front end of the model.
Not the model, Madam Chair, but the current service level calculation.
Okay, the current service level. And assumed, would it make a difference what I assumed for salaries and benefits and all that kind of stuff as to whether I would lose class days, or would it not?
Madam Chair, as long as you make the same assumptions in the current service level calculation that you make in the model, then really what should fall out is your base funding difference, if that makes sense.
No, it doesn't.
Linda, maybe you'd like to discuss the approach that you took, and it might help.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, Linda Ames with Budget and Management. I guess I just think of it a lot more conceptually, and maybe that'll help. If you want a program level in your schools that's consistent with the level we had this past year after these cuts, you will be at a lower program level than the quality ed model was based on the program level at 2001. And that could mean you would have fewer days, or, you know, however you want to define the program. But conceptually, after we took all those cuts, our schools were at a lower program level. We start, if you go back to the 02-03 school year before we took cuts, we were at a higher program level than the quality ed model. And basically, the quality ed model falls right in the middle of 0203 without cuts and 0203 with cuts. I mean, that gives you a sense of the policy decision is more what program level do you want in your schools? Understanding if you want to simply have a scenario that lays things out just like we did for other districts, you were talking about a lower program level.
Okay. So can I go ahead? You're going to say something.
Madam Chair, I was just going to offer that one of the things that we could do once the subcommittee decides some of the assumptions that it wants to make for growth rates and whatnot, is we could present not only the quality education model but also the CSL version of the budget, and hopefully that would tie it together for you, and we could show you what would happen to the CSL level of funding, if you will, with adjustments to the base, and maybe that would help clarify some things to have some numbers.
Would we get to the same place if we did a scenario based on the 3.522 plus whatever we chose for the inflationary assessments, and got a bottom line number there, and then did the same thing adding the $60 million into the base and using the same assumptions and coming up with the bottom line number? Would that also show the same thing?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure I understand your question, because I thought you asked would you get to the same place. And obviously, if you add the $60 million to the base to begin with, you're going to wind up with a higher number in your second scenario.
Yeah.
But then you could take those two numbers.
But in terms of being able to compare where you get in total days, mm-hmm. you could
feed those numbers into the model and find out what that does, those two different funding levels do in terms of your number of school days.
Okay. I would be interested in seeing that, because I think that it is a significant discussion point as to whether we treat this budget differently coming out of the gate than we're treating every other budget that we're seeing. And that needs to be talked about in terms of not only the policy issue, and I'm talking about a discussion at the leadership level, but it needs to also be looked at in terms of the $60 million investment in that budget that is going to take place before any of the roll-up costs and other assessments even enter into the discussion.
Right.
Okay. So I would like to, first of all, have assumptions run both with that $60 million initial infusion and without that $60 million initial infusion of general fund dollars. And let's take members, we need to have a discussion here about what we're going to have as our assumption on growth rates for salaries.
Well, I haven't said much.
This is your chance, representatives.
I have trouble with inflation increases in most any category when, for a couple reasons. All the other budgets we've looked at, because it's the co-chair's assumption that we have no inflation increases. Also, as a business person, I read a lot of business journals, and the overall assumption from economists is that we could be in a serious deflationary cycle as far as the economy in the United States is concerned. And they're looking at another drop in the interest rate because Alan Greenspan is very worried about a deflationary cycle. So why are we adding inflation to some of these categories is what I don't understand. I know the model takes into account inflation, and I grappled this last session when I served on this committee, the inflationary assumptions built into everything that we do. And state government obviously does not operate like the rest of the society does, whether it's a business, whether it's a
home budget or anything like that. But once we start adding and adding all these categories for inflation, no wonder our budgets are out of whack, and no wonder we're short of money. So the governor has said, has asked teachers to take a salary freeze. I'm very serious about that. I would have trouble voting for any K-12 budget that did not include a salary freeze for all teachers, principals, superintendents, and the whole thing. Because we've asked every other state employee to take a salary freeze. So why wouldn't that go with teachers? And it's only temporary. Now, we all represent districts, with school districts, and all school districts are cutting back and they're cutting back and they're cutting back. At the same time that we go into contract negotiations, and the pressure from the unions is to get more and more and more out of a declining pot of money. And I get very upset at that. In September of 2001, after 9/11, my local school district gave, I can't remember the number, we were already in a recession in this state, and they gave 12% salary increases over 2 years. And then they wondered why they couldn't balance their budget. They give a salary increase in the middle of a state biennium. They can't make their payments. They don't have enough money to finish the school year. And then when we're in session, they come back and tell legislators, you're not properly funding education. No, the legislature does not totally fund outrageous salary increases and benefits and PERS and everything else. We can't keep up with that. I mean, I have listened for 2 days and not said a thing. And I keep hearing increased pressure to add more and add more and add more to this inflation. And when I look at the special education increase of 6.2%, that's 24.8% over the last 4 years increase. Where does the money go? And more importantly, where is the money going to come from? Even if we went for this big tax restructuring the state, that is not like going out and picking apples off a tree, people. So I think any discussions that needs, and I think we need to start getting serious. There's been a big complaint in this building from everybody that I talk to, budget negotiations. Negotiations are going nowhere. Well, I wonder why. Everybody's asking for the world and expecting us lawmakers to go find, turn over more rocks for more money. It's not there, folks. So I think the assumptions, if you haven't figured it out by now, I think the assumptions in the QEM are flawed. And I think when you look seriously at them, because you can have any assumption in any model you want, and I voted no on this model twice last session, or maybe three times, because I sat on both education committees. And I sat on the floor in the House, I voted no, because I knew we'd be in this situation. And until we get some more control over how monies are spent at the lower level, I don't see how we can continue to ask taxpayers of Oregon to increase spending in our local schools when our taxpayers don't have any more to give right now.
Assuming from your comments, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is that you would like to see no growth rate assumptions in salaries.
That's right.
Okay. Senator Mesler, you want to weigh in on growth rates?
Well, Madam Chair, I guess I share the, I know I share the same frustrations, Representative Smith. I've served on school boards a few years ago and was always quite frustrated because we as a board, and I think this is common throughout the state, always would, well, I used to tell my board that we'd assume that somebody will bail us out and we'd negotiate for more money than we had in the bank, that we could assume we'd had in the bank without state, or in the, since ballot measure 5, the state would come in and fix our problem for us. I'm also frustrated that at some of the numbers I see in the report on the salary ranking, and I quite frankly I would like to see that for all the districts, not just the 80, I believe, that are in the report. But I thought it was very clear in the governor's speech at the beginning of the session of what his expectations were as he developed his governor's balanced budget. And it's frustrating to me that we at the legislative level are continually blamed in the media and everywhere for the loss of school days when we didn't make those decisions on how to manage their funding. We're doing the best we can. As a matter of fact, we have funded education at a better level than, in my opinion, and not everyone agrees with this, than we have other programs. When you look at the mandates, when you include the mandates that we as the legislature have been placed on us by the voters. So I think the districts, it's apparent to me that the districts have made a choice to negotiate for higher funding, and it's difficult for me to acknowledge that that we have to match that when they should have known very clearly up front what the amount of money was going to be, pretty clearly what the amount of money was going to be available. Some of the contracts that are ongoing is a little different situation, but I think, again, every district had the opportunity to reopen those contracts. So I would assume, I would support the no growth level.
Okay. The I also would like to see the scenario that reflects no inflationary growth in salaries. And the issue that I have here is I'm in agreement with my colleagues, but there also is an issue of equity here in how we're treating all the other state agencies, that we clearly have an expectation that came from the governor's office and has been echoed by the co-chairs that we expect that there will be no increases in salaries or benefits, and to treat the state school fund, I think, differently from other area or from other agencies is a very slippery slope for us to get onto. And I think that there have already been some complications thrown into this discussion by some actions that have taken place in the governor's office by the governor, and that we need to be extremely careful about being consistent and holding everyone that uses state general funds or other funds. I mean, we have treated indeed the other funds budgets that have come before this committee and all other committees with that very same premise, that we need to be consistent. And so I am also very supportive of having no increase in salaries. And Senator Mesley, let me give Representative March an opportunity to weigh in on this.
Well,
I'll come back.
Thank you. Obviously, it's one of the difficulties the legislature has in the construction of the system that the voters have handed us. We have a system which, in the old days, was mostly locally funded, and the school boards answered to their local constituencies, and so raises and those matters in terms of if it was time to try to ask for more money for things, they did it locally. We are now, after Measure 5, we've shifted to where the bulk of the school funding comes from, the state rather than the local level. But we are still left with a governance model based on local governance. Now, I know a lot of us here are frustrated with what our local school boards have done. And there is, of course, no constitutional prohibition from any of us serving on those local school boards and voicing those opinions on our local school boards to try to rein them in at our local level.
Indeed, Representative, there are a number of us that have done that.
But are not currently serving there in those capacities.
It's a little difficult.
It's a little difficult, but there's no prohibition. I mean, the Constitution specifically has prohibitions against some office holding, dual office holding. This is not one of them. We also have contractual obligations, as the Senator mentioned. And I think we, to not recognize the contractual obligations that are out there in some sense, and try to weigh them into the model, and I'm hoping that the teacher salary forecasting model that Mr. Reeder has been working on weighs those in along with the changes and turnover that are showing there. I mean, we have to recognize that we also exist under a body of laws, and we have public bargaining laws that you may or may not agree with, but they are the law of the land. And if the solemnness of a contract is something that the legislature by itself cannot overcome, and there are specific prohibitions on that, so we have to take all those things into consideration. Given all that, I certainly understand the intent and desire. But we also have to recognize those other factors.
Okay. And committee members, the two voting members of the committee that are missing, it would be my intention to talk to them about this issue also, and to see whether there is an alternate scenario that they would request having run. But I think that the three members that are here that are voting members are fairly consistent in wanting to see a scenario that reflects no roll-up rates or growth rates in ed salaries. Let's go on and kind of work our way down the list here.
Sure.
I'm sorry, Senator Masley.
I neglected to add one more point I wanted to make in my discussion. And that is that I'm very concerned that the distribution formula, understanding that the model does not deal with distribution, but our distribution formula in this state, I think, is drastically flawed simply because it does not address the issue of the communities that are not only facing a loss of economy and restrictions from state or total funding to their education, but as they're losing enrollment, they also take a double hit. And it is absolutely devastating, and the outcome of that is that it's much, much difficult, more difficult for them to meet the mandate of No Child Left Behind. And there's just no way that they can catch up. So I just wanted to put on the record that I think that's, and I don't see any activity in this session to change the formula, but I think that's a real flaw in our education system.
Well, and I would concur, Senator, that there are an awful lot of scenarios that all of us face out there in our legislative districts that the funding distribution model doesn't work for. And I think all of us have, at one time or another, attempted to impact the formula and come up against the political realities of trying to do that. It is rather a daunting thing to take on, but I do agree with you that there are an awful lot of situations that the formula doesn't work for. Let's go on and take a look at the other assumptions that are that we need to discuss in order to come up with some funding scenarios. And the first one I think that we need to land on is the substitute teacher pay hike. And as the department has told us, this is statutorily defined. And so I think that we need to think about our ability to mess with that, given that we have no ability to change the statute right now. And my personal preference would be to just go with the roll-up assumptions, the growth rate assumptions that are the standard assumptions. Senator Mesley, do you want to weigh in on that one?
I would agree. I don't think
Representative Smith?
I'd agree.
I'd agree. I don't think it's a very big number anyhow.
Okay.
Madam Chair, if I could just clarify something for the record, and maybe Brian can answer this question. On the GDP implicit price deflator that's used, what is this based on? What is this back in September? That deflator. The reason I ask, Madam Chair, is because I think there's been some change in the deflator since.
Chair Morgan, The forecasts of the implicit price deflator come from the Office of Economic Analysis in their regular state economic and revenue forecast. We haven't updated that. We didn't update that based on the most recent forecast, and I suspect that it may have gone down a tad. We're sort of caught in a difficult place here that typically what we've done with the model is when we build it and develop a baseline, we then use it for impact analysis and have tried not to change the assumptions each time a new forecast comes out, because it then makes it very difficult to compare impact analysis over time. In this case, though, I think that since we're trying to develop a new baseline based on a number of changes in assumptions, that it may be appropriate to update that, keeping in mind that they still are forecasts and can change.
Are we asking you to do some massive reconstruction project here? Or?
No, this is a fairly simple updating that can be done quickly.
So would we be able to assume then that when you run the scenarios that we are going to hopefully come up with here, that they would include an update on the inflation assessment?
Yes, that's correct.
Thank you. The health insurance is a big one, and I think that for me, the information that I think is relevant here is that we have had information given to us that assuming a 9% growth rate over the 2 years of the biennium is probably reasonable, even if we don't end up doing anything here, given the caps that the districts have on the how much they'll pay of the health insurance benefits, and that this indeed may be on the high side of what needs to be. But I think based on that I would be willing to stick with the 9%. Senator Mesley, you want to weigh in on this one?
Thank you, Madam Chair. With the explanation from Mr. Wilson, I had real doubts about that at first, how we could use that figure, but it does make sense, and I would support that.
Okay. Representative Smith?
I'll support it, with the caveat being, I go back to part of my original statement. Fine. Where do we get the money to pay it? You know, we can say that any of these assumptions are reasonable and within maybe business practices, but this is the largest budget in the state fund. And 9% overall for 35,000 plus employees, I don't even know how many it is anymore. Where do we get the money? That's my only thing.
Ms. McGlash, hot off the press here.
I don't know if you want to continue with the health issue.
Let's finish the health issue and then come to this. Okay. This is like news of the minute here. Representative Smith, tell me what you want to do on the 9% assumption.
I'll support the chair, but the whole insurance industry is a far greater issue to tackle than what we can deal with it within this committee. There's a myriad of issues that are drivers. The biggest drivers in this budget are salaries, PERS, and insurance. We've got to try to get our arms around it and a handle around it. We cannot, looking at this budget, say we can give 0%. It would come out of the teachers' pockets when we're already wanting to freeze their salaries. And health insurance is, a pivotal part of employment. I understand that. But I just want to know where we're going to get the money to pay for this.
Okay.
But I'll support you. Do you want to go with that?
And I understand what you're saying, that we are talking about driving the cost up.
And my only question would be, Mr. Reeder, your database initiative, could we get you started out in 99, is that correct?
It actually started with pilot districts in 97, 98, so we have it for a handful, roughly 15 or 16 districts in the first 2 years, and then all the districts starting in 99, 2000.
Was that what percentage of the school population or the school total K through 12 state funding were those pilot districts?
Fairly large, because it included Portland, Salem, Beaverton, and included most of the largest districts in the state. So probably close to half of all the students.
Could we get a historical trend on that number? For insurance, of what the actual database shows, what the number was in trending.
Sure,
thank you. Because that would be my one caveat. Although a lot of people are doing adjustments here and there, when you're averaging a small district and a big district, you got to weight the big districts, and so I.
Well, and I think a relevant discussion item here too is capping.
Right, but there's some people have been capping for a while and
hasn't done any good.
Okay.
Hasn't done a lot of good.
We have an update on PERS rates.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, you were just given a note from Steve Delaney. I don't know if he is in the audience. Okay.
Perhaps we could have him come forward and speak to the committee. Mr. Delaney, thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Steve Delaney, I am the PERS legislative liaison. We were requested by the House Majority Office to contact Mark Johnson, who is our PERS actuary, to see if he couldn't give us a foretaste of what's to come for the July 1 rates. He's still constructing those, but the school pool generally is one that comes out earlier than the others. And so he notified us this morning that his recommendation to the board when they meet on June 30th will be to change the school PERS contribution rate as of July 1 to 11.11% of salary.
And Madam Chair, if I could just maybe put this in perspective, and this does depend upon the base on which you calculate things, but a 1% increase in PERS is about $50 million to the state school fund. So if you're talking about a 0.13% increase, I think that works out to about $6 million. They want to weigh in if I'm not doing that right in my head. So.
In light of that, committee members, I would request that we change the assumption that we're working with from 10.98 to 11.11.
From the horse's mouth. What more can we do?
Is there agreement on that, Representative Smith?
Grudgingly so.
Thank you.
It's better than 17.
It is. Okay, we have talked about health insurance. Computer hardware and software, there have been no roll-ups or no cost increases built into this in either one of the assumptions that we have been using. I would suggest that we simply continue that.
That's fine.
Senator? Representative Bates, what we're doing is going down
what
through.
What the heck are we
doing? We're here in the education
system. I see. If you talk to certain floor members who have to go on and on and on about a bill that passes 49 to zip, I would like to talk to you.
Have some more coffee.
Thank you.
Decaf.
Yes, right.
We've been working our way through some assumptions, and being as we have a scarcity of voting Democratic members on the committee, we should perhaps back up a little bit here. In teacher salaries, after a lot of deliberation, we have asked to have a scenario run that has no growth rate assumption in salaries. Do you wish to go with that assumption, or do you wish to have another scenario run with a different assumption in it?
If all we're talking about is running a scenario so we can see what that looks like, I have no problem with that.
Okay, what we are doing is running scenarios to give to the negotiating team.
Madam Chair, those assumptions may, I don't know what to say about assumptions, they make something out of you and me, right? when you assume something? You remember that phrase? I'll tell you later. Some others know what that means. Making those, and I'm coming late in the conversation, making assumptions
that there'll be... We don't get to play that game, though. We have to do this.
Okay. Well, making assumption that there'll be no salary increases for teachers in the state when we don't have control of that. Districts do. And some districts, as we know from yesterday, are locked into contracts for the next year. Some are not. Some have ways of opening those contracts. Some do not. I do have a little concern that we take a figure like that to the negotiating team, which may not be based in full reality.
So what do you want to do?
I would not do that, Madam Chair.
What would you do?
I would like to take a look at this new data we're looking at, with some which I find very interesting, and think about it for a couple of days. This is Thursday. I don't think we're going to cut a number on this budget between now and tomorrow. I'd like a chance to look at these numbers, go through them, ask some more questions about them. That's what I like to do. You've got the votes to do what you wish to do.
In the meantime, perhaps what I could do is another scenario which uses the data from the teacher salary forecasting model, because that builds into...
We'd run
more than one scenario.
Correct.
That'd be very nice. Thank you.
Oh yeah, we can run however many we want of them.
I was looking to carry away here.
Within reason, but I think it would be reasonable then to run a scenario that builds in the salary roll-ups that the department has brought forward in compiling what has come in on. Negotiate new contracts that are in place. Does that meet your needs?
Absolutely.
Okay. The other thing that is very interesting is that we have PERS, the PERS liaison has come before us and announced that the actuary is going to recommend for the K-12 system to the PERS board at the end of the month an 11.11%. And so we've asked that the model be changed to reflect that rate.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is not insider trading, is it?
We hope not.
Okay, thank you.
Unless you want to join more of that in the courts. We have also assumed talked about health care insurance cost increases, and we've received testimony from COSA that using a 9% increase in the costs is well within what they would expect to see whether or not this process takes action on the bills that we have relating to the aggregating of K-12 because of the caps that exist in many of the districts that cap the cost. So we have asked for the scenario to reflect the 9% rate.
Madam Chair, is there any other group that would be interested in offering a different scenario? I mean, this is one from COSA, right?
OSBA.
OSBA.
And I requested historical data to find out what the trends were, and so we could maybe run a separate one when we get that data.
And did this incorporate information that we hope to get from PEB as far as setting up a statewide pool?
What this number is really based on is that PEB, their anticipated cost increase is 9%.
This is the PEB increase, then?
Yes. So are you okay with including that number in the scenarios?
Yes, I am at this time.
Okay. We were beginning a discussion of the increases, the inflationary increases in computer hardware and software. And where I began the discussion was that in all of the scenarios that have been run so far, including the baseline scenario, there has been no percentage put in here for cost increases on this line item, and so I would be willing in the scenario to continue that assumption that there would be no cost increases. And I believe Senator Meserly has agreed with that, and Representative Smith has agreed with that.
Oh, I have no problem. No, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Anyway, I thought you were just speaking.
In computer networks, we have a cost increase built into the models on that one. This is one that I think, given that there is salaries involved in this, in my recollection of discussions with the department, and given that we have asked that essentially no cost increases be put into, I mean, the way we're treating all budgets is no roll-up costs, I would be very happy to see this be also zeroed out.
Mm-hmm. I would support that, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, I would ask that we, as I asked earlier, I want to see what these things actually meant in real numbers. You're talking about percentage increases, you're not talking about not buying, it was just percentage increases. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what the factor is we're going to be multiplying by these. I mean, the big numbers are up above 85 or 90%, but it would be interesting for me to have an idea of what we're actually talking about here in real dollars. My expectation is this is probably pretty small numbers. You're talking about an increase. They'll continue to have money in those budgets for this. It just will increase.
Correct.
And this is one area. My limited experience with computer hardware and software is that hardware is going down, but software never seems to go down. But I'm not sure what computer networks really mean or do, but I don't expect it's a huge number anyway.
Senator Messer.
Madam Chair, I'd like some clarification. I would assume that a lot of this is contracted and not staff within the
Well, we had discussion from the department on that.
And it wasn't clear.
Chair Morgan, Senator Messerly, typically larger districts would do this in-house and smaller ones would contract it out, although some larger ones do contract out part of it as well.
And I would ask you also to remember that this is just a roll-up factor.
Increase.
This is not affecting the base level of spending.
I would support the chair.
And Representative Bates, do you want to have in the scenario that has the different salary base in it, do you want to have some kind of inflationary factor built into that scenario for this?
Potentially, yes, but it's probably not that big a figure to really make much difference. So I don't want to slow the process here, but I do want to be a little firmer ground of what I'm saying yes and no to. My sense would be I'd like to see what that actually means more than anything else. Maybe it's a minuscule amount of money that we're not even...
Well, I'll put the caveat on this that the leadership negotiating team is expecting some results this afternoon.
Well, gosh.
Ms. Ames.
It's not the first time I've been upset.
Madam Chair and Representative Bates, correct me if I'm wrong, but just to give a sense of magnitude, I think if we zero out all these categories that are short of services and supplies type categories, it has an effect of about $60 million.
Out of a $6 or $7 billion budget.
Yeah.
It's like 1% we're spending time on.
But that would be roughly the effect of eliminating inflation on those kind of.
That's the point I'm going to here. Okay. So eliminating the inflationary thing, we're talking about 1% total budget.
Mm-hmm. Right. So what's your pleasure here?
My pleasure is that I'm still uncomfortable making rash decisions, but this isn't very rash if it's 1%, and I can probably live with it, okay?
With no inflationary increases? Is that what you're willing to live with? Okay. Let's continue down and talk about computer networks, and there is... No, wait a minute. We just did textbooks. We have 8% increase... inflationary increase in each of the years of the bienniums built into textbook purchases. My personal feeling here is, again, that if we are asking all other state agencies not to take inflationary increases unless there is actually no way to get around it, like rent increases and things like that, that we need to be consistent. And I would favor seeing a scenario that backs out inflationary increases on textbook prices. Representative Smith.
Working in a school, it seems to me that we didn't have a lot of extra money for textbooks.
because they are extremely expensive, and they seem to go up, I think, at a different rate. Therefore, we used our copy machine, became our textbook. So don't ask about copyright law violation in school districts, because it's...
We probably don't want to go there.
Probably don't want to go there, but it's pretty common. So I'm concerned about this area. I mean, I'll support that. It's just like anything else. So.
Well, but and also, Representative Smith, please bear in mind that we can run scenarios that have different elements in them.
Can I ask BAM, forgot your name, how much money does this mean?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I don't know the specific line-by-line categories. I was speaking more generally about all these categories listed as sort of generally services.
Just looking at this whole list, 8% is one of the largest categories besides specialized or centralized special education. You know, that would probably be of the 60%, that could be, 15% of the whole budget or something. But, I have trouble with inflation really on anything. So I support no inflation increase.
In textbooks also?
Yes.
Senator Messerly?
I would like to see a special run on this because I think some of the districts have really held back in this area. If I thought they were current and meeting their requirements on textbooks, I would say that they could delay this for some time. So I'd like to see it. I'd like to go to the to a much lower figure, but I'd like to see the run on it.
What would you like? What figure would you like to have?
Well, I don't know. I'd really like to see how much money we're talking about. I mean, it's hard to say without having some figures in front of us.
Yeah, but remember, we have a negotiating team that wants a product this afternoon.
I'm sure I will support the chair until this afternoon, but I'd still like to see more information.
Oh, my gosh. Representative Bates.
Madam Chair, I'll be a respectful no on this. The schools really don't have much control on a lot of things in this list. They have no control on textbooks other than trying to buy them in bulk, and they do that already through various programs. Textbooks are a key to what kids learn in school, and having a textbook to take home and look at to work within school is just too important. I'm going to be respectful to no one.
Okay, so do you want to maintain a scenario that keeps the 8%?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Can we put that in then to the second scenario? And I think it would be helpful if you could isolate what that number actually is.
Madam Chair, I would ask the department, is that possible?
Chair Morgan, I'm just doing some quick calculations here. Currently, districts spend between 60, depending on whether it's an elementary, middle, or high school, roughly $70 per year per student on textbooks and other classroom materials. The savings from no growth in the price of those would be roughly $3 million per year. Mm. So $6 million for a biennium.
So zero
growth relative to the 8% assumption that's in here.
So
now.
Would the $3 million be per year or per the biennium?
Per year.
Per year. So it's $6 million per biennium.
That's correct.
Thank you. Okay. So let's do the scenario both ways and see what it ends up looking like. The next one is classroom materials and equipment, and there is an inflation factor built into that, too. I, again, would suggest that we stick with our no inflation and roll-up here, and that less than 3% roll-up factor here, I think, is that we need to stay with the same scenario that we have applied to all the other agencies.
Fine.
Madam Chair, with all respect to you as a chair, and I'm again speaking that I'm assuming some things I may not probably shouldn't be assuming, but that we do have inflation in the real world, and to buy the same materials it keeps at the same level that we're at now, which is restricted, will require more funds. And this may be something the committee may disagree with.
So you want to run the
scenario with this inflation factor.
I would put that inflation factor in.
Let's reflect that. So, Senator Messerly, what?
I would support zeroing this out, Madam Chair. And if you look at the overall inflation rate, I don't think it really applies to each one of these categories, and so I think it's appropriate that we zero this out.
Okay. The copying, I would apply the same concept to that, that again, we have to be consistent across all of the agencies.
I would too, Madam Chair.
Senator?
I would support that, Madam Chair, but I have a question. I'm noticing that our staff here is using red ink today, and I'm wondering if there's any significance to this.
No.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I wonder if it would be easier to do something. There may be a significant philosophical difference here.
Oh, I'm sure.
Instead of going through line by line and driving everybody slowly crazy,
maybe
why don't we just run two different runs, yeah, with the exception of the computer things, which I think there's a real reason to say things are becoming less expensive and we can get it the same thing for the same for less cost. Could we run one with no inflationary increase in these and all these items other than computers, and one with the inflation in it and call it good?
Would the committee members be willing to do that?
Absolutely, Madam Chair. I think it's a good idea.
Okay. Thank you. You just saved us a huge amount
of time and angst. And
but you didn't get a chance to get caught up on what was in all those line items.
Madam Chair, thank you again.
Okay.
We are going to, Madam Chair, we're going to disagree at times in this committee, and it doesn't mean I don't respect any of the members of the committee.
Oh, sure.
I really mean that. But there will be differences, and I have to express those differences.
Well, and I wouldn't have it any other way, Representative Bates. I mean, it would be wonderful with me if we could agree on everything, but unfortunately...
Well, we can.
As long as you agree with me.
Well, you have to agree with me.
I think then, Ms. McGlashan, am I correct in assuming that we have the information that we need to run the scenarios?
Yes.
And that Mr. Reeder will work on updating the inflation forecast and also the PERS assumption. And then we will take a look at what we get out the other end of this.
Right.
And we have no meeting scheduled for tomorrow. And I believe on Monday, unless anything changes, we are going to take a look at the the Student Assistance Commission. So having no further business before the committee, the meeting is adjourned.